Thanks very much, and I'll add my welcome to that, and definitely say that GeekSpeak is one of our highlights of our technical career because it gives us an opportunity to connect experts that we find in the community with attendees that are looking for lots of good information. So my co-host on the GeekSpeak series is Lynn Langett.
Hey, Lynn, how are you?
How's it going? I'm good. How are you?
I'm just fine.
Are you getting geared up for PDC coming up pretty soon?
I am. Professional Developers Conference happens in my town in Los Angeles from November 17th through 19th, and I'm super excited because we're going to be commercially available with our Azure stack, which we've announced. So we'll have tons of information about Azure and tons of information about Windows 7, another area that I'm super interested in. And I hear you're coming out my way for PDC.
That's true. I'm looking forward to the sessions, but I'm also really looking forward to interacting with the product teams because they've got those booths down there and you can go hang out and ask questions. It's really a great experience.
Yes, it is.
Which is pretty cool. So Lynn and I are both developer evangelists with Microsoft, and we spend a good bit of our time talking in front of audiences at conferences and user groups, and we meet lots of people out in the community. And as I mentioned earlier, the GeekSpeak series is an opportunity for us to bring those experts online and give you the opportunity to ask questions and really interact with them through the format. So for everybody who's attending live today, please, we hope that you'll ask some good questions and spur our conversation on. And if you're watching us recorded, you can just go to blogs.msdn.com/geekspeak and see when we're the GeekSpeaks are in the future. And they're usually every other Wednesday at the same time, which is 3 p.m. Eastern and noon on the West Coast. A couple of things I want to mention also. We are going to be taking notes as we go through today, so as some of your questions are asked and answered by our guest, we'll be collecting all the information that he shares with us and posting that as a follow-up link to our GeekSpeak blog. We've got a link to that blog, as I mentioned what it was before, but it's in the slide deck, so you can check that out. Or if you just go to msdngeekspeak.com, that's another way to reach us. So let's go ahead and bring on our guest today. So we've got somebody from your neck of the woods. Hey, Lynn.
Yeah. Zoinar Tejada, if I'm saying your name right. I'm sorry, Zoinar.
Perfectly. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I had to practice. Is someone who I met at the last TechEd, and I met him after he did his presentation. We had a nice chat about the areas he was working in, and I said, you ought to come on my show. And so here you are. So, Zoinar, why don't you introduce yourself, tell the audience a little bit about what you do in the development world and what we're going to be talking about today on the show.
Absolutely. Good morning, everyone. Well, my passion is all about workflow. I work for a company, Hershey Technologies, that's here in San Diego, and as their chief software architect, primarily I'm responsible for designing their enterprise system for content management, wherein all of that content is driven using workflow. Obviously, my passion stems from that, and as a result of my passion for workflow building that particular product, we've gone into some pretty deep knowledge and understanding of .NET 4 and learning how we can build what was originally built on Workflow 3.0 at our Zendox product into and migrating that into .NET 4. Mm-hmm. Along the way, I've done talks at TechEd on with Michelle LaRue-Busamonte on integrating WebApp, WebCF, and the forthcoming Dublin, the Windows Application Server extensions, as well as written various articles. I just have one particular article that just came out on workflow services, for those of you who are interested. That's available on ASP.NET Pro's website. And there's more forthcoming articles on Dublin and building workflows in more depth on effectively what I'm talking about today.
Great, awesome. Well, a lot of our audience might not be familiar with workflow at all, so we have a number of different demos and things to show you, and I do want to remind the audience as we get into this that GeekSpeak is a little bit different than a traditional webcast in that we like it to be driven by your questions. So we encourage you to type questions into the question queue, and then Glenn and I will pass this to Zoinar. He does have some demos to get us started, and to that end, I think we said we were probably going to start with just a basic workflow demo in case some of you listening in hadn't really been familiar at all with workflow. Zoinar has, of course, a menu of demos, and we really want to present those that are of interest to you. So as we're going along, please feel free to ask questions. So Zoinar, if you want to share out your desktop and probably get started with your first demo.
Actually, if it's all right, I'd just like to start with two slides to sort of set the stage.
Oh, sure,
for the demos
of course.
And,
sounds good.
Absolutely. So here we go.
Yes, the why question. Why is anybody interested?
The favorite one, right? Going? All right. So first of all, why workflow? Right? Who cares? What is it of value to you as a line of business developer or consultant or whatever your particular endeavors entail? Well, there's a couple of reasons, and most of them have to do with this first bullet point of implementation translucency. It's the notion that a picture is worth a thousand words. You can see the code, you can visualize the code, you can model the code at a higher level of detail than individual lines of code. And so this is useful in three different areas. First of all, it's useful because when you're in the process of implementing it, you can run it by the business users. A well-designed workflow is something that a business user can understand. They can read. Right? You're not saying that they're going to be able to develop it, but they can at least read it and give you, yeah, that looks correct. No, that looks wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Secondly, it's useful when you're actually running it because these graphical workflows can be combined with data from the real-time tracking that's going on. So any events that are happening, any data that you want extracted, you can render a version of the workflow with that data overlaid and actually see what's going on inside of the workflow. So there's the real-time visualization aspect. And finally, it's useful in post-mortem analysis, right? Because, you know, things go wrong in these systems. The service that you're trying to talk to went down or the workflow has a logic bug in it, and you want to figure out why. Well, it's very handy to have a graphical depiction that basically has a red X over the particular activity that failed,
mm-hmm.
versus having to wade through lots and lots of activity records in the event viewer or in the database.
So, Zoner, I've got a question about the diagram you have there. Is it possible for the participants in the workflow actually to be in loosely coupled systems or maybe completely separate systems sharing data in some way?
Absolutely, and the first answer to that is what we're talking about today is workflow services.
Okay.
Right. So just the paradigm that you have with what I call traditional WCF services, e.g. those are ones that are imperative and you have code behind them, are ideally loosely coupled if you're following SOA best practices. And those services that you build with workflow services are exposed the same way. So you can talk to services, so your workflow can talk to external services, but you can also expose your workflow as a service where the implementation of those service operations is not code per se, but mm-hmm. workflow activities.
Okay. So, we actually do have a question.
Okay.
It's related to sort of somewhat the diagram you have there. John is saying state workflows seem to be missing in Workflow Foundation 4.0. So
yes.
Maybe we can talk about state workflows and then what happened to them?
Sure, absolutely. So for those of you who were familiar with .NET 3.0 and .NET 3.5's workflow, there was a root-level model called the state machine. And in .NET 4.0, the state machine root workflow has been replaced. Well, not replaced. It's been removed, in a sense,
mm-hmm.
And postponed to a later date. Currently, there are two root models that we have. We have a sequential workflow, which is, you know, just a straight down, top to bottom deal. And I can give you a quick illustration of that. It's like this, right? We have a sequential diagram that looks like that. You know, one activity leading into the next.
Yeah.
The other one that we have is the flowchart diagram that I was showing earlier, right? And those are the only two sort of root flow diagrams that we support currently. And what's happened to the state machine is effectively it's a matter of time, right? The state machine itself will be released for .NET 4, but more than likely it will be released after RTM.
Okay. So people that are trying out the beta now and it's not in there.
Right.
Okay.
So to give actually a more precise answer as well, and I'll dig up the URL for this, Glenn, the team has actually published a document that cites how to build equivalent workflows using flowchart and a couple other activities such as the pick to get the same or equivalent results that you would have gotten with a state machine.
Okay.
So they pretty much removed that, it's completely a blocking situation because there are semantically equivalent workflows that you can build using flowchart.
Okay.
So any other questions there? Or I'll continue on with the value of using workflow in general.
You can keep going.
Okay. Great. So there's two more major points, right? And that is that with this workflow model-driven approach, it enables you to develop a domain-specific vocabulary. And that vocabulary is one of your activities, right? So on this particular diagram, I'm using all out-of-the-box activities. But you can imagine, if you will, that say I have, in this case, I'm looking at reserving an order, right? I could have an activity that interacts with the inventory database, right, to verify that that order can be reserved and commit the reservation to the database, et cetera. So we can convert those actions into activities and allow our users to drag and drop them from the toolbox. So little by little, by fleshing out your custom activity library, you develop this domain-specific vocabulary.
And that really has been key for effectively using workflow since its inception, the proper use of activities, I think. You think that's still the case and maybe even more so going forward?
Even more so going forward, because the Achilles heel of workflow in 3.5 was that it actually allowed you to write code inside of your workflow,
mm-hmm.
right, which defeated that purpose, right, because your goal in writing a workflow is to build this reusable domain-specific vocabulary and discourage you from just throwing ad hoc bits of code, right, because then you're losing that implementation translucency.
I agree. So now are you going to show us?
Yep. So, long story short.
I'm giving you a hard time because we rarely allow any slides, but we made an exception for you.
Right.
Absolutely,
well,
it helps.
Thank you very much. The long story short is that, in this particular case, picture's worth 1,000 words, but what's an animation worth? And get rid of that. My copy of Windows is complaining here.
Now, okay. Tell everyone what environment you're working into.
So I am working in Windows 7 with Visual Studio 2010 installed, Beta 1.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So what I wanted to show you first off was one of the values of workflow right out of the box before we jump into workflow services is some of the features you get for free, and especially for ISVs, this is extremely useful. It's the notion that the same design environment that you have inside of Dev 10 or Visual Studio 10, you can rehost in your own application. So this is an older version of what I've been working on for my client that allows us to open up a XAML workflow. Nothing too fancy here. All right, we can open up the XAMLX or the XAML workflows, use that workflow designer to visualize the workflow, allow users to drag and drop from our version of the toolbox, and once they've defined the workflow, actually be able to visualize its execution.
So to be clear, what you're showing here, the Zendocs, this is an application you wrote?
Yes. This is an application I wrote.
Yeah.
And I use it simply because, yes, we can accomplish this with the debugger, but this allows us to sort of design and execute in the same step without slowing down, and attaching to a particular process and holding up all the threads while that workflow is running.
So the question, of course, to the people watching is going to be, why would you just not use Visual Studio?
So for developing a workflow in general, using Visual Studio is more than likely adequate. In a situation where you're an ISV and you want to control what users can do in terms of what activities they can drag and drop, and
basically
think about it.
They're customizing their installation of your application.
Exactly.
Or not so customizing.
They're adding specific logic or adding specific value. Or you don't want them. I suppose the answer is better stated. You want to ensure that you're targeting the end user correctly, right?
Right.
Visual
right.
Studio is very good for the developer. But if you want to lower the bar a little bit to maybe a technical business user, then they're not going to be comfortable in Visual Studio.
Right.
There's just too much overhead for them to learn.
And another one that I've seen is a commercial one, K2.net.
Mm-hmm.
They've really jumped. They've been a leader in this for a long time, and they've really jumped on the bandwagon. In fact, when I was in South Africa, they actually showed they have a multi-touch enabled version. Which, so you can do multi-touch and drag the items, the activities around.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
Wow.
So the sort of the interesting, I think, point for the developers watching is that creating this environment for the business user could be part of the solution that you as a developer create.
Absolutely, exactly right.
The analogy I usually use with folks is, are you going to write a system that has canned reports, or are you going to bake a report-generating tool into your system? So this is the same thing, but to another level.
Right. Yeah, so it's the same thing, except that perhaps you're developing middle-tier logic.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure if you guys were watching while that was executing. We were talking about something else at the time. I can close this up and run it again. But the principle is pretty simple. What I want to do is I want to build it and I want to run it. Visual Studio supports the debug, like we were talking about. But as an end user who doesn't have Visual Studio, how do you provide them that experience, right? One of sort of my mantras in this particular project has been we want to reduce the cycle time in the build, debug, deploy, right? And the way business users think, if you think of how macros are typically written in Excel, right, is a user will go ahead and build a small piece of it, run it, see that it worked the way they wanted it to,
mm-hmm.
and then add more to the logic and run it again, right? When they have a problem, they want to catch it sort of as soon as possible, right? So they're, you know, making little changes and running it, making more changes and running it until they get to a sticking point and then they figure out what to do to fix it, right? And you want to remove all the pain involved in making that complete cycle. And so this is a pretty good solution because you're able to just go ahead and run that particular workflow, visualize it, get data out, and as one of the things that, you know, as you see here, this data that's getting spit out at the bottom, right, we're actually tapping into workflows, tracking infrastructure to get this information. And the workflow infrastructure includes these things like workflow instance records and activity schedule records and various different forms of effectively tracking records. And these tracking records tell us, okay, this activity was executing, this activity is about to be executing, this workflow started or this workflow completed. But it can also tell us things like, this particular variable was set. You know, if we had variables defined in this workflow and we wanted to extract values that had specific meaning to our business user, we could also display those by tapping into the tracking records that are being generated. So on the whole, it's a pretty cool environment outside of Visual Studio.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is, you know, a big selling point of workflow without even getting into workflow services.
Yeah, it's an important point, but again, I don't want to put the cart before the horse. So if you don't mind going back to Visual Studio and perhaps just going over some core workflow components, because again, as you probably know just from giving your talks at TechEd and around different places, we have a ways to go with adoption. I don't know what percentage of our .NET developers are using workflow, but I would be willing to guess it's less than 25%.
Absolutely. And so with that, let's migrate into talking about workflow services.
Yeah.
Perfect. So here we are inside of Visual Studio. What I've done is I've created a very simple service. Right? This would be sort of the equivalent of one of your first WCF clients or one of your first WCF services. And these are accessible. So the type of project, we'll just start from the beginning here, is this is a declarative sequential service library. That's the project template that you use to kickstart it. And with that, you'll get a XAMLX file. And the default gives you a sequence that has two activities, a receive and a send response.
Now, if you were looking at this in the context of earlier versions of WCF and WF, those things had sort of a tenuous arrangement between the service and the endpoint you're exposing and then the workflow execution that you're trying to wrap up and put inside of that. But here, it's sort of unified, right? You're going to have an endpoint. You're going to have a series of endpoints with address and binding and contracts and whatnot.
But all of which we choose to
configure. Instead of workflow, you're going to have your activity right in there. Is that right?
I'm sorry, I don't understand the last bit of your comment.
So the actual execution within the service is not lines of code, but it's activities in a workflow.
Correct. Okay. That's exactly right. So if we were to implement this in WCF, all I want to do is have a service that allows me to add two values, right? I want to expose the service operation as the word, as labeled as add, mm-hmm. right? And I want to take a payload that has, you know, operand 1 and operand 2, right? And then I want the return message to contain the result of that addition.
Okay.
So the equivalent the implementation of that in workflow looks as follows, right? We have a receive request, which is the canonical activity that's available on the toolbox. I'll show you those guys. That's available on the toolbox to receive incoming messages to the workflow. And that's irrespective of it being one way wherein the request is received but no reply is sent to the client, or request reply wherein the message is received but a reply is also formulated back. Most workflow services, I would argue, are going to be of the form request reply, and that's what we're doing here. But what I did to build this one is dragged in and receive. And so if you start to think about it, these workflows have some form of implicit state, right, in that I'm kicking off a workflow instance, right? So the first question you ask is, well, if I want to add this, how do I'm going to call a service, I'm going to call add, how do I kick off a new instance of that workflow to begin the processing, right? And so when you add a receive, the first thing you want to look for, if it's the first one in your workflow sequence, is this can create instance. By having that checked, the workflow services runtime knows, okay, when a message is received to this particular operation, go ahead and launch a new instance of that workflow. So we'll have that instance loaded and running, and we're going to get the values that were passed in by the client to this parameter here called data. And what we've done is we've defined a variable here that's of type arguments, and I'll show the implementation for that in a moment. And basically, how this reads is, it's an operation that's called add. It takes the parameter data, and if we expand what the arguments looks like, you'll see that the arguments is basically a data contract, right, where we have two double operands. And so this is currently the way that we define a operation with two parameters, right, is we have to go ahead and define a separate class. So this is one of those slight exceptions to the rule of let's not have any code in our workflow services, because in this version, we need to define our data contract for complex payloads. So once I have that data, right, I can perform the add in various ways. I could, where this arrow exists, right, I could put in additional logic, I could be doing, you know, service calls, I could be doing database lookups, or what have you. But one of the neat things about workflow that helps to reduce the amount of custom code you have to write is its support for expressions. Right, so you see here, I'm actually performing the addition sort of in line with sending the response. Right, so here I have in the value for send response, I'm taking data's operand 1 and adding it to the data variables operand 2. And that's the value that's going to be returned to the caller. So I didn't need to write any code to perform that addition operation. If I wanted to use some other classes that are already available, like from the CLR, I could use those in the expressions. Now, the key point about these expressions that seems to trip up a lot of people is that they are in VB syntax, because there's a VB compiler that's running behind the scenes to process all of these expressions. But once, you know, you get used to that flavor of writing your expressions, if you're not a VB developer, it's extremely convenient, because now you have the ability to execute sort of ad hoc code without writing too much code, without writing code files.
Sure. And that's not built on the DLR. That's just the VB.
Correct.
Right there.
Yeah.
Okay.
So let's go ahead and take a look at what I'm going to do is I'm going to run this guy so you can see that workflow services are true to that SOA tenant of hiding the service implementation details, right, such that you can surface highly decoupled services, right? You bind to the contract, not to the implementation, right?
Right.
So what that means is the client should see a service. It shouldn't know that it's talking to a workflow. It shouldn't matter, right? It could be a workflow. It could be code that's actually performing the implementation. So what I've done is I just hit F5, and that brought up the Cassini host here, the ASP.NET development server. And we can click on the XAMLX, and this will pull up the service information screen from which we can pull out the WSDL. While that is loading, I've pulled up the WCF test client, and I'm just going to pop open a connection to that. So the WCF test client, right, looks at the WSDL that this XAMLX exposes and creates a dynamic proxy.
And just to be clear, WCF test client ships as part of ES 2010?
It does. It actually has shipped with Visual Studio 2008,
yeah.
I believe Visual Studio 2005.
Not but again, because this is new for a lot of developers, probably haven't had time to even know it's there.
Right. Right, exactly. Thank you, Liz. So, jump in here. What you'll see is it created this request for me, and here's the payload that we defined. It was arguments, right? And it's of the type that we defined by our data contract. I can drill in and put in the two operands, four and three. And this is actually one of those things that, for those people who are new with the WCF test client, watch for the drop-downs that appear here. I run into many developers who have tried this tool out and found, you know, decided that it's completely useless because they're stuck at this level. It's like, how do I create a new instance of argument?
Bad
like,
UI,
you
bad
click
UI.
In, right? Now we can specify those two values, and I can invoke that workflow. And once it compiles, you'll see Visual Studio is flashing up in the background. Takes a second to run here because I'm running in a VPC. We get our return value.
Hmm.
Right? So that's pretty cool because it was really easy to write a service. I mean, if you reflect on the implementation I showed, I didn't write any code short of the data contract for the payload.
Right. And I'm assuming that the template, when you created this new project, automatically gave you a config file that set up the endpoint and the contract and everything.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
It automatically set it up with the basic HTTP binding for me in this case.
Basic HTTP binding, okay. Now, you could easily convert this to perhaps...
WS? Or
I was thinking like XML or JSON or some of the ways that you can have sort of internet-friendly services.
Well, the story with REST is kind of where you're getting at, and
yeah.
workflow isn't that in workflow services isn't really that developed.
Okay.
It's more along the lines of you have your basic HTTP binding and you have your WS HTTP binding, and NetHTTP works fine, name pipes works fine, but the REST ones are still unstable, and it's kind of uncertain as to how much support for that will be at RTM.
Okay. But for the most part, people that are used to the paradigm of building a service and then creating a proxy with add service reference and coding against the proxy, there's really nothing different that they would do from a consumer perspective, right? Because as you said, it's just an API that you're coding against, and you don't care that it's a workflow behind the scenes.
Right.
Okay.
That's very true. So, great. We ran it. We saw that from the client's perspective, it looked just like a service, right? We don't see anything here in the test client that says, yeah, this is a workflow per se.
Right.
Now, to speak to Lynn's point of, okay, well, what does Visual Studio offer out of the box? Well, let's set a breakpoint on that. I still have it running. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start a new proxy here, and we'll invoke it again. And this time, we'll jump in. And this is, you know, one of the series value adds here is we get graphical debugging on the workflows.
Mm.
So here we are at the receive. We actually do have the ability to see some of the values. I believe it's under locals here, that were passed in. So far, the receive hasn't found the data. Let's step forward one. Loading. There we go. So now we've received our payload, and we can actually take a peek at what was sent in.
Nice.
Great.
Nice.
So we have both the ability to inspect variables that are defined in the workflow, as well as to step through a workflow using the workflow designer and the workflow debugger. So I'm just going to run that to completion. And we'll be done.
So while we're enticing our audience with all these fancy features, one thing that I don't want to gloss by, because again, we have not the level of adoption that we're hoping with this, and you've been working with this in production with clients for quite a while.
Right.
Can you talk about some of the business scenarios that you've implemented workflow in, and where it's been particularly successful, so that developers can understand?
There's a few particular scenarios that it comes in handy. The main one has to deal with anything that requires a long-running process. And so if you think about something like human workflow, right, where you are mixing people providing some input to the system with the system having to do some steps in an automated fashion, and because, you know, the time frames of people and systems working together might be days or weeks or months, you need some way to efficiently manage the resources and manage state effectively. What workflow provides is the notion that it's able to handle these bursts of execution. So a user, say, submits their approval, the workflow wakes up, does its processing in response to that approval, and then gets persisted back into storage, sort of minimizing its footprint in memory. So human workflow is a pretty valuable scenario for implementing these long-running services. Now, it's also becoming the case that because of the ease with which you can, you know, design these workflows and the ability to rehost the designer, you have this new ability to allow end users to easily define new logic for your application, to create pluggable modules, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the speed of the workflow runtime has been enhanced, and I would wager significantly, but obviously we'll wait to RTM to make some of those statements, such that you can have these inline workflows that I like to refer to as computational workflows. They take some input in, they do their work, they execute, and they usually run, you know, from start to finish completely and return a value,
mm-hmm.
right? So what it is, it's the equivalent of programming with blocks,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's another area where workflow really shines and is a good business scenario to keep in mind.
Mm-hmm.
When would there be a case where the workflow design surface would not be able to express what you're trying to do? You know, if you're talking about receiving some data and maybe it's you're going to call some link queries or something like that, would you just be able to layer that in as a code block, or do you have to basically abandon the workflow paradigm and just go back to sort of standard WCF?
So let me repeat the question, make sure I understood it. So you're asking, well, what if I wanted to use something like Link or Entity Framework to talk to my data store?
Well, not specifically those, but are there those kind of situations where you'd say, well, that doesn't make sense for us to do a workflow service, we're just going to do a traditional service? Are there those things, and if so, is Link and stuff like that an example of that?
Or I would say no. The reality, the approach that you would take, say you wanted to talk to your database and you wanted to use Entity Framework, would be to create a custom activity. And you can think of it in the simplest terms. The custom activity is going to have one body method called execute, right?
Okay.
And in the body of that execute method, that's where you write your code that interacts with your Entity Framework model or performs your link queries and actually does that work. So, yes, there is a place to put code, but the place where you put that sort of custom code is in a custom activity.
Okay. So basically, why would anybody choose regular WCF services versus workflow services in a given scenario?
That's getting to be an interesting question.
There
are certain limitations to workflow services
mm-hmm.
In the realm of security and in the realm of the types of the way you can expose some of these contracts.
Right. Well, maybe the REST one that we were talking about
and
earlier.
And the REST one is a good example.
Okay.
So there, it's the 80%er case here, right? Like,
sure.
Workflow services really covers what the common case is for building a service. There are those outliers that you just can't do it. So that would
sure.
be one, right? And when I say things like security, I'm not saying that it's not possible with workflow. It's just it got complicated, right? It's like it requires additional work. So, that's a factor for a lot of line of business developers just trying to, you know, get their day job done.
Right.
Which would they choose? Now, one thing I would emphasize is you get to talking about workflow services. One of the features that really has value for either is the notion of the monitoring, right, and the being able to debug it. And where I'm going at that is, you know, Dublin, right, the Windows Application Server extensions. You're able to actually see what's going on, seeing both the tracking records that are emitted from workflow as well as the service operation calls that are coming from WCF. in a correlated fashion, which is fantastic, right? So the one advantage that using a workflow versus a WCF service that occurs there is that the workflow can actually start correlating across various service calls for you, right? So you have this end-to-end tracking, like you had in just the straight WCF tracking. If you ever used a WCF diagnostic trace, you have those end-to-end identifiers. But Dublin offers a UI that allows you to sort of piece those together so you can see, oh, well, this workflow called out to service A, and then it came back and it called out to service B, and it called out service C, and it failed.
Right.
So we have a question from one of our listeners that's kind of is similar to what you're talking about here. He says, so if you deploy the workflow to a middleware server, does it take full advantage of multiprocessors or multicores?
That's a great question. I'm not sure I have a very specific answer for that one.
Okay. Well, one thing that we always do with this show, and we'll just talk about it now, is we do have a blog on MSDN, because sometimes you guys will ask questions that we don't have the exact correct answer for, and we don't want to give you conjectures. So we'll take that as a homework question, and we'll post that on the MSDN GeekSpeak blog, because my feeling would be you'd hope so, but we will look and we will verify it. So great question there.
Yeah, that's one of the things you would trust the runtime to do. If
yeah,
it's
yeah.
Right. I have no specific answer for 4.0. In the 3.0 case, it was certainly the case that it looked at the number of processors that you had and used that to determine how many workflows it could run simultaneously, and that's how it scaled. How that has changed in the 4.0 stack, I don't have a clear answer on.
Okay.
Great. Here's another one. On long-running workflows, where is the data stored? When would you use workflow services versus a BizTalk server?
Okay, so let's start with the first part.
Okay.
Where is the data stored? Well, when you're talking about a long-running process with regards to workflow, you're always talking about this notion of persistence, right? And the workflow runtime out of the box supports persisting to a SQL Server database. So your data is going to be stored there. There's a set of scripts that you can run that are inside of your framework directory that will create those tables for you. Let's go here. I'm not seeing them here, but I'll get you the path specifically later on here. But long story short, those SQL scripts will create the tables that are required, and they'll be persisted to a SQL Server database. Now, what gets persisted is a very minimal portion of the state of the workflow. So when we're talking about these workflows, we're talking about Zamalexes.
So let's say, theoretically, you had this workflow, but it didn't know how to calculate the sum for whatever reason, hypothetically. But it needed to persist this, and then at some point later, a human's going to visit this, see the two numbers, update the sum, and then the workflow continues. How would you actually code that or design that?
So, okay, an implementation of that would be allowing it to persist waiting for that human interaction.
Okay.
Right? So if it was an error case, you might have maybe thrown an exception or something and said, hey, I don't know how to compute this sum.
Okay.
In which case, you design your workflow to route to another receive request, right? And the advantage of the receive request is that implicitly, they put the workflow in what's known as an idle state, and the workflow runtime allows you to persist workflows when they go idle. So that workflow would then be written to the database. Now, on top of that, the workflow runtime also has a setting for controlling unload on idle, right? So if it's been persisted, it's idle, and it's not doing anything, we should just get it out of memory, right?
Right.
So those two things coupled together will mean that once it's waiting for the user action to come through, it's safely stored in the database.
And would that user then interact with an application that talks to another endpoint for another service, workflow service, and then find out what's waiting on my input and then pull it up and do whatever they need to do?
Try that again.
So how does the user then figure out what workflows they need to get involved in and contribute
Gotcha.
Do so they can continue.
So, yeah, okay, so what form of UI or how do you query for
yeah.
that? Well, that really is up to your application to implement.
Okay.
Out-of-the-box workflow doesn't provide anything that readily answers that question.
Sure.
You can certainly get at the data to be able to say, okay, these are the workflows that are waiting on something, and these are the operations that are available on those workflows. But there's nothing that's going to give you that UI. You have to sort of create that.
Okay.
And so that's where the second part of my answer to the first
yeah.
question is, well, your data is, you know, your workflow state, and that is where it currently is in the workflow, as well as the values for the variables in that workflow instance, are persisted to the SQL database.
Mm-hmm.
But more than likely, you're also going to be storing a lot of your data outside of the workflow, right? Because, for instance, if you're dealing with business data, you're going to be tracking it in your business tables. You're going to be updating your data in those tables because they're easier to query, right?
Oh, I see. Okay. That makes sense. There's a question in here about the designer, actually, since we're kind of looking at the visual designer. He's looking, the question is, the VS2010 Workflow Foundation Designer generates declarative XAMLX files, but I do not see the C-sharp behind code as I could in the previous version. So is that still something that's needed? Is your code
great
behind?
Question. So, yeah, that is exactly what .NET 4 Workflow is moving away from supporting.
Hmm.
Right. So for those of you who aren't familiar with it, we'll take a peek at this particular service and see the XAMLX. Right, so we can open this up with the XML editor. And what we saw the graphical representation of previously just looks like this. You'll notice that there is a notion of the sequence here. There is a notion of variables. We have our expression being computed here. But what you'll see is there's no code, per se. Right? There's no C-sharp code. And that's because the XAMLX workflows are completely declarative. That is, they're all this XML. So where do you put your code, right? And so the more complete answer than what we've gotten, right, is, well, sometimes we have types that we need to reference from the XAMLX, like we showed for the arguments, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's one way. In this particular example, I am referencing a type that I've defined in the same project, but it could be an external library, just the same. If you're looking at a workflow, the other way that we've discussed for getting your code in there is to build a code activity, right? And build your own custom activity and write your code in that custom activity and add that.
Right.
And then there's this third way. Let's see if I can pull it up here. Called the invoke method activity. And so this is about as close as the designers of the workflow runtime want to let you get to invoking code ad hoc in a workflow, right? And the invoke method is what it does simply is allows you to specify a type, and then it will create an instance of that type, and then it allows you to specify the method, and it will call that method with whatever parameters you specify. So it's not writing code per se, but it allows you to link in external libraries without going through the complete step of building a custom activity to wrap those external libraries.
Okay.
Okay, we have a little bit, kind of a different twist of a question from one of our listeners here, but it's an interesting question, so I'll throw it out there. He says, will this work with Windows Azure?
Yes. I've actually built a prototype where I had a workflow listening to service bus requests.
So before you just answer it that shortly, we should explain to our listeners who might not be familiar with Azure that there are three core components. There's application hosting, it's called Windows Azure. There's a SQL Azure, which is a similar but not exactly the same as an RDMS in the cloud, and then .NET services, which is what Zoyner was talking about.
Precisely. Yeah, and what I'm talking about is the latest rendition that doesn't include workflow in the cloud, right? So if your question was, does this work in the cloud, where you're running the workflow actually on the Azure platform, the answer is no. But if the answer is you want the .NET Services service bus to call into a workflow that you're running on-premise because that's your service, works fine.
Great.
Okay. Any other questions?
Let's see what we have here. We have, this is a kind of a specific one, so let's see. I'm going to ask the people that have the two questions to restate them a little bit more simply. So, no, you can keep going if you have another demo you'd like to show us.
Okay, great. So one of the value adds of developing a workflow service is this notion of content-based correlation, right? And this is sort of a problem that gets solved out of necessity, right? And it's this. You've started a workflow, like, say, ad, right? And remember, as Glenn was saying earlier, what if I need to do, you know, wait for another human activity to come in with some data in the middle of it? So if you think about it, every time we call into a workflow instance, we're starting a new workflow instance here, and then they get to this idle point. Now, sometime later, we get a call in that needs to go back to precisely that workflow instance. How do we identify that workflow instance? Well, that's the notion of content-based correlation, right? And so what content-based correlation does is it looks at the message that's coming in, say, for instance, what we had here in our data contracting arguments, right? It looks at one of the values and examines that value, and that's the value of what we're defining as our content-based correlation maps to the instance ID. So it knows how to tie those two together. And the workflow runtime transparently passes that message over to the correct workflow instance for us, which is pretty awesome. So let me show an example of that. Here we have the content-based correlation project. And we'll quickly explore how that's implemented. And I think we'll run it first here, but let me pull up this guy. There we go. Okay, so what I have here is a very simple example of content-based correlation. I have this first call that comes in, and let me rearrange this so it's a little bit more visible to you guys. The layout sometimes gets mucked in this when I save and it crashes on me. It happens. Okay, so we have this first call that comes in, and basically it's a simple request reply. I'm going to pass some data in. The data is of type in 32, and I'm going to return that data back. Then I want to call into this same workflow and have it respond to this second call. So I can do that using content-based correlation. So let me run this, and then I'll show how we actually configure that content-based correlation. While this is loading, the real value add of content-based correlation is that it allows you to build services that are asynchronous to the processes around them, right? So if you imagine you have a long-running workflow, it's going to start off doing some bursts of processing. It's going to go to sleep. And meanwhile, or it continues doing some other work. Meanwhile, you're waiting for someone to call back with that necessary piece of data, right? Content-based correlation enables that asynchronous work. And if you think about the sort of code that you had to write to build an asynchronous, basically to write anything asynchronous, it's not the easiest code in the world to write. With content-based correlation, you're basically just setting properties. Here we have. Let me create a proxy to it.
While this is adding, there are a couple of questions. One question here is, where are the VBScript expressions stored for the workflow designer? Can we generate our own or modify the generated script?
So the values of those expressions, I don't know if you caught it when I was zipping through that XAML there, is actually stored in the XML of the XAML.
I did, but I don't think this person caught it. So
right, I'm just reiterating. Absolutely. So, yeah, they're stored in the XAML.
Okay, great.
Could somebody generate their own easily and just sort of drop them in there or have them as an external reference somehow?
There's no easy support for having it as an external reference, but the generating it is a pretty easy one. If you consider, at the end of the day, the XAML is an XML file, so whatever XML processing tools you're familiar with, you could use to generate, you know, the entire workflow, including the Visual Basic expressions.
Okay.
So let's fire this off now that guy's ready. So I'm going to just enter an integer here to kick it off. And this is simply a metaphor for what you would probably have as your business payload, right? In the case of, say, an invoice system, right, it might be, you know, the invoice number or some combination of the invoice number, vendor name, and invoice date, or, you know, a social security number, something along those lines that uniquely identifies this message corresponds to this instance of the workflow. So what I've done by doing this call is I've kicked off the workflow with the value 45. So now I have this instance of the workflow running. I can then call into this workflow again because I've configured the content-based correlation. So as long as I enter the same value. So let's take a look at that working, and then we'll take a look at it. Actually, what we'll do here, let's look at a failure case. I think that's always insightful. So we'll see here, it says the requested operation could not complete because some instance key couldn't be found. That makes sense, right? We didn't have a workflow instance that was waiting for the value 45, negative 42 to come in. We only had one for the value 45. So let's change that. We're going to invoke it. And this time around, we should simply just get our response back. Right, so that's cool because we just continued the execution of our workflow from where we left off.
Mm-hmm.
And why this is a benefit is that by looking at the message payload that's being exchanged, we don't have to add special values to the headers of these messages. If you're familiar with framework 3.0 and 3.5, we had to add a data context. We had to add a context header that included the instance ID, which is a GUID. And so that forced our clients, the clients of these workflow services, to always pass in that workflow instance ID in the header to be able to communicate with the workflow instance. It's more natural to be able to correlate on some sort of value, some business portion of the body of the payload.
So how does the correlation exactly work then? Because I am actually pretty familiar with the previous. There's still got to be a GUID under the hood. Is it just hidden?
Yes, no, that's exactly. There's definitely workflow instance IDs under the hood left and right. But the way the correlation works is there's this notion of a correlation key store, right?
Okay.
That as the workflow is running, so this is a great segue, Lynn. Thank you for showing how I configure this, right? I'm going to set up the correlates with, right? So this is the first activity that's coming in. And by setting it up here, I have a handle that's a correlation handle. You can think of that as sort of the opaque black box that's wrapping all the data that we need to correlate on for this workflow instance. And what we do with a correlation handle is define an XPath into the message, right? And it's not, strictly speaking, a true XPath. It's a variant of the XPath that's interpreted by the workflow runtime. So basically what we're saying here is I can use this editor, and my message includes an INT32. Right, so by going through this UI, I can select that out, and it writes the XPath for me. Right, remember, data was just an INT32?
That's very nice.
So that's going to initialize the correlation.
Yeah.
And that initialization basically means in workflow runtime infrastructure somewhere, it's writing down, okay, 45 just came in, and this correlates to this GUID.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Then when we come back and we have another receive, we use the same handle, and we provide that correlation again. And simply by lining those two things up, the workflow runtime takes care of resuscitating the workflow instance that's supposed to receive the message.
Yeah, the old hydrate and dehydrate and all that good stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
Now, if the second call is run, you could go back and start the first call again with a different signature, right?
Yes, that's exactly right. It could run it with a different one. In some cases, depending on how long your things are sticking around for, you can run it with the same one. The workflow instance has been, you know, completely finished and its keys have been cleared out. You could reuse that identifier.
Got it. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any questions?
Well, one, you know, again, as people are seeing this and they're wanting to get into it, because, you know, I've been working with this stuff really since its inception. I did production work with it when it first came out, so it's really fun to see where we've gone with it. But, you know, there is a learning curve. You know, it takes kind of adjusting your thinking in solution building to incorporate this. I always like to ask people that are actually working in production with this stuff, what are some things that you wish you had known that you know now after having worked with this for a number of years? What are some, you know, lessons learned basically for people just getting started?
Okay. I would say one pseudo surprise for us was, you know, in building workflow services, you know, we still had to have an understanding of WCF. So because workflow services, as I like to put it, are the result of WF and WCF combined.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So especially for some of my team members, right, that was, you know, something of a learning curve that they weren't expecting to have to deal with.
So in terms of getting your teams ready for full-on WF, really making sure that they have a good core understanding of WCF.
I would say a basic understanding of core WCF is definitely important.
Mm-hmm. And what resources do you use with your team to bring them up to speed if they've not worked with it?
So I find that a lot of the postings on MSDN are good. I like Michelle's Learning WCF book. It's phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's Michelle LaRue Bustamante.
Correct.
Michelle is a local to us, so I know we talk because we are local to each other and we kind of know each other, but we realize that people listening come from all over the world. So Michelle LaRue Bustamante, and it's Learning WCF by O'Reilly. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the ones I like to hand my team when they're just getting started. And I will usually pick out the sections that are of value. You don't need to know everything about WCF. You're just having an understanding of how you build a basic service and what are the ABCs, the address binding and contract, are important to building workflow services.
Anything else in terms of specific to this version or this rev of WF? Because this, you know, it's been around for a little while here. Anything that you've learned in this particular version coming out?
So, anything particular?
Mm-hmm. And maybe the answer is no. I don't know. I'm just
I'm not sure that there's anything specific to this version. Granted, you know, this rev is quite a bit old. So, for instance, those arguments that we had to define in code, you know, that was known then as something that was not acceptable. So, you know, they've been working on making that experience much better and making it so that you really don't have to write code to build a simple XAMLX workflow service.
Yeah, I think that's probably the key takeaway from this is the ability to do it through the designer, have the debug experience, and have them exposed directly to services. It's pretty cool.
It is very cool.
Well, so we're at the top of the hour, so I've taken us to a slide that lists a couple of good resources, our GeekSpeak blog here at blogs.msdn.com/GeekSpeak, and our attendees can go there and look for, in a couple of days, we'll have a post with a lot of the links related to the concepts we discussed here today. For those interested in attending live, we do have a GeekSpeak coming up on October 21st. It's going to be refactoring tips and tricks, some cool stuff in there. We've also got recordings of our shows that we have on Channel 9, and I've got our blogs linked here as well. Feel free, anyone who's watching this or listening, to reach out to us, and we'll try to give you the resources that we can to answer your questions. So, Lynn, thanks for co-hosting.
Great. It always fun to work with you, Glenn. And Zoiner, thanks so much for being on. Really enjoyed all the information that you shared.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
And we'll turn it over to our webcast producer to do some wrap-up.
Oh.